Good afternoon. Thank you all for being here today, and welcome to the 14th annual Dr. Lewis B. O'Donnell Media Summit. My name is Bonnie Quattrochi.
And my name is Abigail Barcavoli. We are students here at SUNY Oswego who have had the tremendous honor of being a part of this day as co-event directors. Before we begin, please take note of these announcements. We would like to extend our gratitude to everyone involved in today's event. Our panelists, moderator, and career connectors have all traveled to be here with us. Thank you to the School of Communication, Media, and the Arts, faculty and staff members, our folks in the alumni office, the alumni that have joined us today, Michael Rickey, Lou Borelli, and President Stanley.
Special thanks from us to the student e-board we had the pleasure of working with tirelessly over the past few months, all in preparation for this day. We could not have done it without you. In case of an emergency, please make sure you identify the closest exit from your seat. If you need to leave for any reason, please do so quietly and respectfully. Restrooms are located outside of the theater. Head out the doors you entered through and walk straight ahead.
There will be time for questions at the end of our discussion. The moderator will let you know when it's time to approach the microphone in the aisle, so please wait for that announcement. We ask that you form a line up the aisle at that time. Please remember to silence your phones if you have not already.
If you need to record your attendance for coming to this event, there is a QR code located on the inside cover of the program. It will ask you to fill out a quick assessment of the event anonymously, and once that is completed, it will then bring you to a separate webpage that will ask you for your student ID number. And with that, your attendance will be recorded. This survey will not be live until the conclusion of this event.
Lastly, a networking opportunity is available to all of you immediately following our panel discussion in Tyler Art Gallery. You will have the chance to meet career connectors who are four alumni. Please join us and enjoy light refreshments. I have been lucky enough to be a part of this summit for 2 years, and it has given me so much to be thankful for. Experience, knowledge, and friendships I will truly cherish forever.
This event has been a huge part of my experience at SUNY Oswego. I am so thankful that I have gotten to play such a large part in an event that is truly bigger than myself for the past 3 years. As Abby and I get ready to graduate, saying goodbye to this event is bittersweet, as we will miss the hand we had in it, but are eager to see where it goes in the future. At this time, it is our pleasure to give a warm welcome to the podium, SUNY Oswego President Deborah Stanley. Please enjoy the 14th Annual Media Summit.
Well, welcome to the Lou B. O'Donnell Media Summit, the 14th annual. It seems impossible that that is true. SUNY Oswego campus is always vibrant. It's an exciting place to be. I know that many of you are here all the time, but today it's even more so because we have some very special guests with us for the 14th annual summit. Our visiting experts today have been meeting with students and speaking in classes, and we want to thank you for that, helping students in the School of Communication, Media, and the Arts develop a keen sense of what it takes to turn a message into action, and we'll hear about that today. Now we have arrived at this event, which is being streamed live online. The Media Summit is, of course, the brainchild of Lewis A. Borelli, a 1977 graduate of SUNY Oswego, who wanted to honor a longtime Oswego professor, Lewis O'Donnell, Doc, as he was fondly known to his students and faculty. He was a true mentor. He provided students with good advice as they made their way through college and into the creative world of broadcasting, even as we knew it then. His passion for learning and doing became the passion of his students. One of his students is Lou Borelli, and Lou is here today. Lou? Lou went on to be a pioneer in cable television, online media, and broadcast production services. For years, Lou was instrumental in televising major entertainment and sports networks' worldwide events, from the Olympics to the Oscars. The Media Summit at Oswego started in 2005. Later, he got together with his good friend, Al Roker. You may have heard of him. And they christened the summit in honor of their shared mentor, Professor O'Donnell. Al Roker, as you know, is also a graduate of SUNY Oswego, just 1 year ahead of Lou, but Lou always reminds him of that, I know, when they're together. We are grateful for Lou and Al's commitment to the Media Summit. For 14 years, we have welcomed leading professionals to campus to tackle some of the most pressing issues facing media industries. Today, that tradition continues. An incredible group, as you can see here, of distinguished professionals, eager to help us sort through the very timely theme of this year's Media Summit, Viral Voices, Advocacy in the Digital Age. Our panelists were chosen because they have firsthand experience and an in-depth understanding of how social networks and digital media can change minds, influence action, and just maybe improve lives in the process. They'll tackle grassroots campaigns launched in many cases by social media novices. They'll explore the evolution of social media movements born from hashtags, and we all know because we all subscribe to some of those hashtags. They'll examine brand advocacy and how to establish corporations and startups are leveraging digital media to advocate for a cause, and much, much more. Aside from this panel's impressive professional experience, you're certain to hear some incredible life stories along the way, stories that help us understand what it takes to persevere and pursue one's passions. Moderating today's discussion is Asa Stakel, SUNY Oswego class of 2012. Asa is an award-winning broadcast journalist. He has plenty of experience with social media, and he's certainly covered plenty of campaigns that we're going to discuss here today. Asa is becoming a familiar face in the Albany television market. He anchors News Channel 13 Today, weekday mornings in Albany's NBC affiliate WNYT. It's a pleasure to have you here, Asa. We got a chance to talk earlier, and I very much enjoyed it. To the future pros in the audience, and I know you're here, we're thrilled to have you here, as you too will experience the summit and learn something along the way, we hope. Hold them accountable. Ask some great questions. Asa, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you, President. Thank you, President Stanley, and thank you, everyone, for coming in here today. Personally, this is really an honor for me to be back here, coming from SUNY Oswego, graduating in 2012. So thank you to the Media Summit for choosing me to moderate this discussion. And I think we have an exceptional panel today to shed some light on viral voices, advocacy in the digital age. It is my job to ask questions for the next 50 minutes or so, and then the audience will have a chance to ask some questions of their own. So please come up with some questions as we speak, write them down, and then you'll have a chance at the very end. Let's meet our panelists. To my direct left, we have Brandy Boatner. She is IBM Social Influencer Communications Lead for Global Markets at the company's New York City-based Corporate Communications Office. It's a long title.
Very long.
That means Brand Management, Social Media, External Relations. Brandy wears a few hats at IBM, and she also holds several leadership positions at the local and national level of the Public Relations Society of America. You're also known as the Beyonce of the business world.
I am. You can affectionately tweet that, everyone. Beyonce of the business world.
So welcome, Brandy.
Thank you, Asa.
We also have Gina Ilyev, who's been on the ground floor of several grassroots advocacy campaigns. She currently uses her skills as a communication strategist and community organizer for Planned Parenthood of Central and Western New York. She serves as the organization's health equity coordinator. And when she's not organizing a movement or trying to create change, she's working on graduate research at Syracuse University's Maxwell School. So Gina, welcome. Next, we welcome Jeff Knaus. He is an alumni. Jeff is the co-founder of Digital Hive, a full-service digital marketing agency with offices in both Syracuse and Rochester. And this year, Digital Hive was named the fifth fastest-growing advertising company in the entire company and the 57th fastest private growing company in the U.S. by Inc. magazine. Very impressive. Jeff's also an active member of the community. He serves on several nonprofit boards, including the Oswego College Foundation. And he is an 07 Oswego alumnus and an avid skateboarder still to this day.
That's right. I also own a taco restaurant, so if anybody's in Syracuse, I have a lot on my plate.
Welcome, Jeff. And finally, a very familiar face, Dr. LaToya Lee. She's an assistant professor of sociology right here at SUNY Oswego. You're a scholar activist, and your research focuses on the ways in which people of color use social media for political organizing and social transformation. You earned your bachelor's and master's degree from St. John's, and you hold a PhD from Binghamton, and that's part of our SUNY family. So we welcome you as well.
Thank you.
All right, so we have a panel with a diverse set of experiences and knowledge in digital advocacy. Let's first start by defining the term. Digital advocacy is an organized effort to influence public perception by digital means, whether that be by a company or by an individual or individuals. So we have people from the business world, we have people in grassroots, and we have Dr. Lee, who has studied this since the beginning. So I'd like to ask each one of you what you can lend to this discussion, why you're here, and what you can tell us. So Brandy, we'll start with you.
Thanks, Asa. Well, why am I here? I think it's because the food was really, really good here. I'd never been to Oswego before. Maybe it's Lake Ontario why I'm here, but no. In all seriousness, I think because my name is Brandy Boatner, I like alliteration. So I say when people ask me, you know, give me your elevator pitch, I said it's 3 D's. I'm all about data, I'm all about digital, and I'm all about diversity. And so if you look at digital advocacy, it just really speaks to me because I am a huge, huge advocate and champion of inclusivity and diversity and inclusion, being a woman of color in a very corporate tech world, which sometimes can be difficult to navigate. But what that means to me and why I'm here is I think I have a certain perspective that maybe students and teachers and academics and those watching want to know. Like, how do you really drive change? How do you practice inclusive leadership in a corporate setting, in a business setting? And then specifically in today's environment, how do you change behavior? Maybe not necessarily mindsets, but how do you change behavior, particularly on social media? And I know we all see a variety of things on the gram and on Twitter and on Facebook, but what does that mean in the business world? So I'm hoping today, with some excellent questions from our moderator, that I am able to address some of those. And then when we get to the Q&A, I hope that you all think about what would you want to know about inclusive leadership from a pretty large tech company from a business perspective. So that's why I think I'm here. Michael, is that right? No, I'm just kidding. That's why I think I'm here.
And I'm really excited to see how the business world fits into all of this. So I'm really excited for our discussion. Gina, how about you?
Hello, everybody, and thank you for having me. I think digital media is particularly interesting because oftentimes we think when those hashtags pop up that they're new, that it's a new movement or a new language, but oftentimes those movements are already going. Think conversations are already happening. Communities have already been there. What's important about these digital moments is how we scale them up, if you will, or how organizations and grassroots movements can capitalize. So it's those hashtags don't always come out of organizations like mine at Planned Parenthood. Oftentimes they just are someone who tweeted something out that day. And it's my job to kind of look at that landscape and capture all of you in that change and bring it to the ground and see how we can take those hashtags and move them forward.
Okay, certainly turning something on the internet into action on the ground is something I'd like to talk about as well. Jeff, what do you have for us?
Yeah, so I've been in the marketing and advertising world for over a decade now. I started in broadcast television prior to starting Digital Hive. And, television was the original form of influence, right? Being able to see the messages, and there's iconic commercials and presidential speeches and all kinds of things that have influenced us. But as digital evolved, so did my career, and that's really why I took the step to to leave the broadcast world and start a startup called Digital Hive with my partner. We were just two guys in a 200 square foot office prior to us now being the fifth fastest advertising marketing company in the country, which was a huge honor. It's my everyday job is to really advocate for the brands and clients that we serve for. So if, as an example, SU Athletics is a client of ours. So if anybody, there's any SU football or basketball fans out there, we do the marketing advertising to help drive ticket sales and things like that. We also do a lot of political advertising. So we help candidates, tell their story a little bit better through very targeted means on social media, Google, all kinds of things. And so I'm hoping that through the conversation today, I can help lend kind of a perspective of how advertising and marketing can really influence, the consumers that we're trying to tap into and really tell a story to hopefully either buy the products or services we're offering or, win an election.
Okay. Dr. Lee, you have a wealth of knowledge on this. What can you lend to the discussion today?
Well, I'm happy to be here. Thank you for having me. And yes, I have been studying this for some time, not from the very beginning, because this has been going on before I even knew about digital advocacy. But I've been studying the ways that people have been taking to social media to be able to create a voice for themselves, be heard, speak to a particular community of interest, in particular, people who feel that they are often voiceless in society. And the ways that they've been using that to kind of carve out a space for themselves, to engage in politics, to engage in social politics, and the economy as well. And that's what I'm here to talk about and to discuss more about the strategies that have worked, what has not worked, and what it all boils down to. What can you do if you plan on using these spaces to be able to speak to a particular interest?
Fantastic. Yeah. So many voices out there. It seems now everyone has a voice and at some point the ability to access millions, billions of people. Advocacy today, in the digital age, how is it different today? What's different about today than before?
Well, I mean, there's Twitter and then there's Black Twitter, right? Mm-hmm. Or there's Twitter, and I mean, I don't know if there's Latina Twitter. There's a Latina Twitter. I think there's an LGBT plus, so the platform was created for us to kind of go this one to many with a tweet. And of course it's evolved. But now, like I said, there's Black Twitter, Latina Twitter. So you see, to Dr. Lee's point, there's communities within communities using the platform for their community. But wasn't that the whole purpose of Twitter to begin with? Was to one to many for a community? So I think it just shows you that the voices that feel that they need to have a specific kind of subset of a platform, that's changed. Because I think if you were to talk to Biz Stone or anybody who founded Twitter, they would probably say that wasn't the intent, was to have a platform within a platform within a platform. They wanted to have this community, but people said, well, we appreciate Twitter for what it is, but we want our own so that we can address things that matter to us. Or I'm feeling marginalized, so I want to use this as a way to connect with, other people. But now, everyone is their own, publicist, cheerleader, anyone can get online and share an opinion. And a lot of people either agree or disagree, but I think overall, to the earlier point, it's if you have a particular interest on something you want to advocate for, there's a ton of people digitally that you've never met all around the world that will advocate with you. So I think that's a huge, the evolution of just kind of social and digital advocacy, I would say.
I think, building off of that, it's a bonus. I mean, you do want these communities to have conversations amongst themselves. That's not to say there's not a downside. We also need those communities to have conversations with other communities. And sometimes these media spaces actually block that conversation off. So it's the job of people like me to come in and try to make those connections and have those conversations and pull it off, sometimes offline. I mean, we can have them in those spaces, but it's much more difficult if you don't make the face-to-face contact. And I think that that's where the change is, especially for advocacy purposes. You have to add nuance, and oftentimes you can't get nuance unless there's critique. And in those spaces, that can be very difficult.
I think that there's a lot of good and a lot of bad with social media, right? And one of the tough things, I think, with social media is that it tends to be an echo chamber, meaning, you know, if you feel a certain way or you have a certain opinion, the way that the algorithms work for a lot of different social medias is that you like or comment or share those things that you agree with. And then so you're fed more of that and then more of that and then more of that. And so all of a sudden, that's why I feel like a lot of the division is happening in America, because, you know, so often we see something that we agree with and then we engage with it, and then the algorithms say, oh, you like that. I'm going to deliver you more of that. And so then your opinion becomes stronger and stronger to this side, right? And you almost lose that balanced approach. I think the thing that's changed is that, you know, television and, you know, the radio, and I mean, I think about, like, FDR's fireside chats, like, that was one message delivered to the entire America at one time, right? So whatever the positioning or whatever the opinion was or non-opinion was that was being delivered, however that communication was delivered, it was delivered all in one time. Now it's so fragmented because everyone has a voice, because everyone's an influencer and everyone can voice so many different things. You know, I know last year's Media Summit was all about fake news and how much that gets shared and how much that, I mean, think about the fact that there's so much less vetting now to the information that we deliver. So I think that that's one really big struggle with social media, is that it almost turns into this, you know, reinforcement of whatever behavior or belief that you have. And sometimes that's just what causes people to get so confrontational about it. You know, instead of having a great dialogue, instead of being able to sit down and have some real discourse behind something that's important, instead it turns into, well, this is why I'm right, this is why I'm right. And so I think that that's really a big portion of what social media has changed, is the way we have conversations and the way we're fed the information that form our opinions, right?
I agree with my panelists here, but I think also that what is interesting about traditional movements to now these current movements that have been taking place online is just the tools, a lot of the tools. The strategies remain the same. The fight oftentimes remained the same over the years and throughout history, but the tools have changed. So social media has made it easier to be able to disseminate information in a specific way. Social media has made it easier to reach a larger audience, right? So where prior would be flyers that would be handed out, now we have hashtags, right, where we could send information and organize a quick meeting, et cetera, right? And I do agree that social media is a double-edged sword in terms of creating this echo chamber where all you're hearing are voices that sound like yourself, right? I do think that we need to interrogate that not necessarily everyone has a voice on social media. It oftentimes depends on how big you are, whether you have a blue verified check, whether you have enough followers to have a voice, right? Because there are other ways that we like to ignore people or block people because they don't have enough followers to tell me anything about, you know, what I think. So I think that that's also should be a part of the conversation also.
What is it about a message that brings you outside of that community and goes viral and motivates action? How does a message by an individual end up triggering a whole movement? What goes into that? What are the similar aspects that really can bring a viral voice? I know that's a tough question. If we knew, we'd be doing it all the time.
Yeah, right, everybody would be viral. I think a lot of it is just about the commonality that you can get behind the message that's being delivered. You know, I think about a few different things where, you know, I mean, I'm probably the least qualified person to talk about the Me Too movement at the moment on the panel. But, you know, as a proud father of a daughter, I think it's important that men do speak about it. And for me, you know, when stories started to come out about the Me Too movement, what really resonated for me was the courage that the first person took to really begin having those conversations. Because in the 1980s and prior to that, you know, I think sexual encounters in general were just different, right? Like the expectations were different on both sides. And so as we're evolving as a society, I think it's an incredible conversation that we're having, because it really opens up the things that we should have been talking about all along. And so I think what's really cool about that specific movement is after that first person came and spoke up, it just allowed other people to have voices that didn't feel like they had voices, right? And I saw this one really great post about how, you know, with you know, sexual abusers and what people criticizing them. Why did it take you 20 years to speak up? You know, literally, the reason that they had gone through what they went through was because they weren't allowed to speak up, right? They went through a horrible, traumatic experience, and during that process, they weren't allowed to speak up. So, of course, it just feels to them like they need to keep it to themselves. They were either ashamed or embarrassed or whatever. And so I think that's one really good side of social media, is that it has opened up people to have the voices that they have and be able to have the courage that may have been harder for them to do so because there's others. So I'm very appreciative of that.
To add to that and to link what Dr. Lee said, the Me Too movement started 10 years before the hashtag. I mean, somebody did say it.
No doubt. Mm-hmm.
But you wait years and years and, you know, Twitter, you know, comes to life. And someone famous says the same thing, you know, after, of course, there's a, you know, shock with the presidency or, you know, whatever sparked that movement, but it did start 10 years previous. Yeah. And then how do we give weight to the people who said it first is probably the hardest part about this. And again, to your point, where it becomes safe to say it, I think most of us who are old enough to remember when MySpace started, like all these other things, you would never say anything like that on your MySpace.
Nobody. Do you guys know what MySpace is?
Please tell me you know what it is.
Because like no one said anything. I was like,
yeah,
it's pretty cool. You can put music on it. I like it better than Facebook.
I learned MySpace. I coded my profile picture with like stars floating around. It was dope.
But I think, you know, you needed to, that moment created a space where it was okay to put your story out there, and I don't know that, at least at this point in my life, that would have been something any one of us would have done before that hashtag came out. And, you know, even now I see all these stories, and they're great, deep stories and sad. It's just hard for me to personally want to go and do that, but it's lovely that that space was created. But we need to figure out how to listen to those who have been there already.
I'll just say that oftentimes we find that with a lot of these movements, they end up emerging for purposes of disseminating of information. Either there's censorship of the government censorship, so they take to social media to be able to be heard through organizing, right, to plan and schedule meetups, and then also as a part of proaction or even reaction to something that has happened, right? So we oftentimes see a lot of these movements emerging because of one or many of those three reasons.
Yeah, just to, again, piggyback off of what my panelists are saying, the reaction to something, and then also what Gina had mentioned, when celebrities, you know, kind of, I guess, validate in today's world with digital. Some of you may be too young, but remember the Ray Rice video of him and his now wife in the elevator, and I think he hit her and she passed out or whatever happened. So domestic violence was a really hot topic at that time because of the video proof. They just kept showing the video over and over and over. Just a very disturbing image. So a hashtag started on Twitter for domestic violence, those who had been exposed to domestic violence, and the hashtag was hashtag why I stayed. Mm-hmm. Because everyone was wondering why would his wife, she was his girlfriend, but why she would stay with him. That everyone in America and everyone in the world had seen this video and how horrible this is, and why don't you leave him? Why don't you leave him? So this movement started, right? Hashtag why I stayed. What was interesting about that movement, like you said, reactionary, another hashtag started right behind that on why I left. I followed the why I left more than the why I stayed, just for my own. I'm not, domestic violence is not something that I've personally had to encounter. But I was so curious about the why I left in contrast to the why I stayed, given in this whole like Ray Rice kind of scenario, that it was just, and again, someone just started, is domestic violence a new topic? No. Is it something that we've talked about many years prior? Yes. But these two particular hashtags on why I stayed and why I left, for whatever reason, for me, sparked something and then sparked in other people. And I think to the original question Asa asked, talk about a viral voice for on both sides. Yeah. So again, it was a reaction to a celebrity or an athlete or something that had happened that had very, very impactful, lasting kind of impression, I felt.
Yeah. Gina, back to your point on Me Too. You said it had been around for a decade before Me Too actually started trending. So Tarana Burke had been working on this for 10 years, And then Alyssa Milano tweeted out and said, if you've been sexually harassed or assaulted, write Me Too as a reply to this tweet. And all of a sudden, it explodes.
Yeah. Right.
So, is this just a mirage? Or do we still have, do we all have a voice that could be powerful in the digital age? Or is it the same as it's always been? You have celebrity status, so you have a little pull.
You know, I'm not entirely sure I know the answer to that, and that's okay. I mean, I do think we all have a voice. Don't be shocked, I only have like 50 people who follow me. I'm not cool on Twitter. But, you know, for the people who follow me, I have a voice. I don't think it's necessarily important that you have 100,000 people hear what you say. I think it's that you said it is what makes it important.
Yeah, when something goes viral, it just means that person that either retweeted it or shared it or engaged with it, that person, it resonated for the person.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think it's on an individual level, you know, whether it's 50 people or 50 million people, I think that everyone can make an impact. And I think that that's how social media is being utilized from an individual level. It's just what is your, you know, contextually, what is your opinion on these things? And people choose to engage with it or they don't. Mm-hmm.
I've seen interviews with Tarana Burke, and she's just happy that the message is out there, right? And that more and more people are having these types of conversations, right? Yeah.
Switching to the business world.
Let's talk business, eh? So.
So, digital advocacy for you guys. You guys are spreading ideas, trying to change people's perceptions, their ways of thinking. Mm-hmm. How do you do it, and what does that mean for a business?
Wow, that's not a loaded question or anything.
Yeah, right.
Gonna give away the corporate secrets. How do we do it? Everybody take notes. No, it's an excellent question. And I think every, you know, corporation business is different. I'm going to kind of give an example of what we do, and then I'm gonna give an example that I think everyone can kind of resonate with. I'll start with that one first. So Nike. So we have a whole kind of in the business world, you know, brands that take a stand against any kind of social injustice or what have you. And regardless of where you sit on the Nike issue, whether you are a Colin Kaepernick fan or you're not, whether you agree with the kneeling in the national anthem, regardless of what side that you're on, none of us can argue that as a result of the entire 30-year campaign, Nike has profited $6 billion. None of us can take, like, again, wherever you sit, $6 billion, that's with a B, they have made as a result of taking a stand. And when you look at brands that do that, Dove, you know, took a stand, you know, with women and their appearance and kind of tackling on the fashion industry and like what it looks, you know, a woman looks like in the morning, you know, what have you, you know, True Beauty, I think, was their campaign. When brands address issues that we talk about, it says something about the brand, because a lot of people, particularly your generation, it's not about what you sell, it's about who you are as a company. You guys resonate really well with companies that you feel align with your personal values. That's why you shop there, that's why you buy their products. It could be like, oh, I don't really care what they sell, but I know that like every dollar goes to X and I support that cause. This generation feels very strongly about that. So when brands take a stand in the business world, it really, really means something. Now, for me, Nike's a consumer brand. I am a business-to-business brand. And we really tout diversity and inclusion around just making the employee experience at IBM one that is a safe, authentic environment where you bring your entire self to work. And so one of the things that we have a mantra that says, I believe, I belong, I matter. And no matter where I am or whoever I'm talking to, I will say that I want you to repeat after me, you believe, you belong, you matter in anything that you do, because that's how we do business. We couldn't be a $1 billion company. We couldn't be 107 years old if we were somehow exclusive of anybody or anything. We wouldn't be successful that way. So we treat diversity and inclusion the same way that we treat innovation with technology. It is critical for business success.
That's great.
Jeff, you work with political campaigns. You work with Syracuse. Two totally different things. How do you do it?
Yeah, so, digital has transformed the way that marketing and advertising has been around for a long time. I'm back to Mad Men days. I don't know if any of you watch Mad Men, but that was a great show. And, you know, guys smoking on Manhattan, you know, in Manhattan on their couches and coming up with creative campaigns and putting them on TV. I think all forms of advertising can work. You know, I want to start there because whether you're doing TV ads, radio ads, billboards, newspaper, it all can theoretically work. It's what's different about digital, what digital's really done for brands and businesses is they've allowed them to target them in a very specific way. And so instead of, I always give this example. When I was in TV, if I had a brand that I'd work with, let's say it's a furniture store, and their target demographic is a mom, she's 35 years old, she has two kids, she lives on the east side of Syracuse, you know, she drives a certain car, I'd probably put that commercial in Ellen because I think that that's a good demographic for people watching. The problem with that is 95-year-old guys watch Ellen. My 4-year-old son loves Ellen. I love Ellen. You know, who doesn't love Ellen? And so while that's a good place for it, theoretically, you're not going to be 100% hitting that exact audience. Now, if I want to reach a 35-year-old woman, lives in Fayetteville, has two kids, drives a Subaru, loves dogs, has a household income over $100,000, a FICO score over 700, and recently went to Target, well, I can talk to just those within a 10-mile radius of, you know, their store in the east side. I can talk to just those people. So not only, and there might only be 10 of those people, right? But my dollars are going to be spent on my perfect audience, a very specific audience. And so the targetability is super critical, and then also the measurability behind advertising, right? So before, when you'd run a TV ad, I'd say, hey, how's your TV ad campaign working? And they'd say, yeah, you know, pretty good. My cousin called the other night, said he saw it. I said, all right, well, did your cousin buy a couch? Then I don't care, right? Because what does that mean to me? But it's really hard. And that's, again, TV ads work. I couldn't spend 8 years in television and say they don't work, right? They absolutely do. They're great for branding. They're great for getting a word out. But what you can do with digital is I can literally say, all right, your ad was served by this 35-year-old woman. She saw the ad. She engaged with the ad. She clicked on the ad. Then she went to your website. Then she landed on the homepage. Then she went to the About Us page. Then she went to your couch section that you were going after. She went to this specific couch. She filled out a form and bought a couch. Like, I can take it all the way down the funnel. So all of a sudden, I can use that data to say, yeah, you want to reach 35-year-old women, but you want to reach 37-year-old women that are really, you know, they're more interested in this image than this image, or they like this video better than that video. And so data is a huge resource in advertising, and we haven't really been able to utilize the data of what's working, what's not. And so all that boils down to, now all of a sudden, if I'm, you know, SU Athletics, they have a limited budget, right? They need to spend a certain amount of money to try to get more season ticket holders to buy season tickets this year. So we want to make sure that we're serving the ads to the right people with the right creative. If we're running a mayoral campaign or a state senate campaign or a sheriff's campaign, we want to make sure we're talking to their constituents in their areas that they're running their campaign in, and we want to make sure that the message is resonating with those people by measuring the engagement. And so never before have you been able to ensure that there's going to be reliable return on investment before than digital, and that's where, you know, we've seen some success.
And I think in business, in the same thing in advocacy, everybody wants that return on investment.
Absolutely.
They want their message out there, mm-hmm. and then they want an action. Do you think a lot of these digital advocacy campaigns fall flat? Everybody jumps onto them, but then there's no action taken.
I would say it's true. I mean, hashtag all day. I love when you guys show up at marches. Great. But I actually need you to sign the paper so I know who you are. Because it's very difficult to track everybody who hashtags. There's no way for me to do it. Probably you could. But I cannot. I work for a nonprofit. So I actually need you to come see me. Hi, how are you? Sign this paper. Paper and digital need to meet at some point. I know we hate that. We have tried having those same things online, but getting you guys to click and open it and stay is very difficult. I don't know that people love their email anymore either. So we've moved away from sending you things through email. But in order to get, you know, advocacy moving, to get you in front of your local leaders, we actually need you to sign that paper and come out with us. It just is what it is. I don't see that changing anytime soon.
Dr. Lee, what do you say?
I think that we are in an age of slacktivism, or slacktivists, right? Where you just hit that like button and you've done your duty for the day.
That's it.
Just go have some coffee, put your feet up, right? You're done. But I also know that there has been change on the ground through digital activism, through the tools of social media. For example, Occupy Wall Street was able to get the word out. You guys familiar with Occupy Wall Street? Okay, good. Occupy Wall Street was able to get their message out and actually spread internationally, right? Across the globe. BLM, Black Lives Matter, began after Trayvon Martin's murderer, George Zimmerman, did not go to trial, and they was actually able to push for that trial, right, which was the case that we saw on television. Because of their activism and because of what they did, their protests and reaching out to, you know, going beyond just social media, reaching out to their congressmen, et cetera, they were able to push for actual trial, right? So there are cases where I've seen that there has been, and again, it's not just by hitting that like button, but it's by putting in the actual work. In California right now, there have been activists who have been pushing a lot of legislation through and getting it passed. So they have been, there is a lot of work, and there has been a lot of work done.
I think to add a point to you,
yeah.
You guys, pressing like, I have never met a congressman or a senator that just was like, oh, that hashtag was so great, I'm just going to do what you want. You actually have to go and call them and send them letters and, you know, go to their office.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, just to put a finer point on that.
And one of the ways that people have been able to use social media in that way is by sharing Congress information. This is the telephone number to contact your congressman. This is their business email or address, send them this letter, send them an email. So that has been useful in that sense to be able to reach such a wide audience.
I just want to give an example to what they're saying in the Slacktivism. I 100% agree. You've got to take the next step other than the thumbs up or the heart. Like, we need to move beyond that. But example, Slacktivism. I call it something different because it's a popular term that the young kids, I consider myself still young, okay? That the young kids use today. But do you guys remember Nightmare on Elm Street? Do you guys remember that movie? Might be too young, but the villain is Freddy Krueger, right? How did Freddy Krueger hurt people? When did he get them or kill them?
In their dreams.
In their dreams when they were asleep. Okay, this movie came out 30 years ago,
alert.
84, right? So Freddy Krueger killed people in their dreams in their sleep. And they would say to the girl, the heroine in the first one, Nancy, stay awake, stay awake, stay awake. And your generation, and you kids today, like to use the term of staying woke. Stay woke, and I'm not going to sing the Childish Gambino song today. But stay woke, that's not new. That is not new. That came from a poem in the 40s during the Harlem Renaissance about people being more aware of their surroundings, particularly ethnic surroundings. So stay woke is not something that just appeared. To the Slacktivism, I am here to tell you that a lot of you in this room, a lot of people in America are asleep. We are asleep. And just like I said with Freddy Krueger coming and killing you in your sleep, we have to be woke. And I say woke. But this is the thing about staying woke and being woke. You say you want to be woke, but you don't. Because you don't take the next step, and you don't take the action, and you don't. So for all I know, Elm Street is your permanent place of residence. Because you are woke, right? So if you want to hashtag stay woke, well then, talk to your congresspeople. They are very awake. I mind you, they're wealthy and awake, right? They're very aware of what is happening. We who are sleeping and having wake me up from this nightmare, depending on what district you live in, wake me up from the nightmare, you all have to take the next step. So if you really want to stay woke, if we all want to sing in unison and make Donald Glover happy, that's Childish Gambino, by the way, for those of you who don't know. If we want to make him happy, let's really understand what that means and take action to do it.
Yes, yeah, voting, right? You heard that. It's true. And y'all need to get to
wake
vote.
Up.
We I can't mean, vote on our phone. And
hashtag stay woke.
She came in hot on that.
I did. I'm very passionate about this.
Yeah, I could not tell. that was dope. And you know, it's so true. And I just try to plead to people that are younger that, you know, Like the first step is really voting. The first step, like calling a congressman, all those things, incredibly important. But first, educate yourselves, find out who your political candidates are, and just vote. Like it's that simple. And people die literally trying to get the right to vote. So now you guys have it. And trust me, I was the same way. Like I can't even deny. When I graduated, even from Oswego, I was just like, politics. Bush, got bad guy, because I listened to a lot of crap that was like this, you know. And so I didn't have an informed opinion, so I felt like, well, I can't vote because I don't know enough.
Right.
And it's really is like the internet has made everything simple to learn. Everything. I used to have to read from encyclopedias. So
what are those? What,
right? Like just you actually may not know. The thing is, I totally agree, and now it's time to get active.
Yeah. Okay, so we want to stay woke.
Yes, thank you.
I guess so.
Thank you.
To summarize. Students out there today, we're talking about all this digital advocacy. How can they use what we're talking about up here in their daily lives as a college student and then moving on and as a professional?
Sure. I don't think that you guys here at Oswego and college students realize just how much power you have. A lot of you think like, oh, but I'm just in college, or oh, I'm just young, or oh, I'm just this. Like, we're really good at like telling ourselves, oh, I'm just this, or I can't do that. Particularly college students are good at telling yourself what you can't do. Mm-hmm. You guys need to stop doing that and tell yourself what you can do. You all are so, because you are digital natives and you're digital disruptors and you're at a learning institution that clearly creates really amazing people, you're getting top-notch education, you have so much power, because you know what they say, like the after-school special, knowledge is power. You guys are sitting on top of a treasure trove of knowledge here at this university, and anybody who's in higher learning, she can tell you she's an academic. You need to exercise that in your day-to-day. Now, I'm not saying I want you guys to leave here and go on campus and tell your professors, do you know how powerful I am? I could have you fired tomorrow, Michael. Like, I'm not saying that is what you go and do. I want you all to truly understand you are at a time in a nation where things are just really messy and ugly and sometimes visceral and just downright mean. But you, with the knowledge that you have in your day-to-day, what you're studying, I don't care what your major is, you can make a difference. Stop listening to the voice that only you hear that tells you, oh, you can't do that. You can't say that. You can't go there. You can't talk to this person. All the can'ts, oh my goodness, just get rid of that and really embrace where you are and how you can help us as the professionals, with the digital advocacy that we're out here doing. Like, my time in college is over. I wish I could go back sometimes, because adulting is hard. God, is it hard. Like, nobody told me about taxes. God, they, like, hate me because I'm single and have no dependents and take all my money. But aside from that, you all need to just realize where you fit and just how, again, the disruption, the chaos that you're comfortable with, embrace that. Embrace your knowledge. Embrace that all of you show up as your authentic self. Embrace that, because that wasn't, you know, not my parents' generation, the generation that we are. So I would just say, to be digital advocates, as I'm sure you are in your day-to-day, just understand the knowledge and the power that you have.
Let me ask about the digital side of that. You said you were checking on my Twitter last night.
I was very disappointed. I told him.
I know.
I told him.
And I admit, it needs some work.
It does.
I need a little branding.
With Brandy. Beyonce of the business world.
So how do you take that into the digital side? How do you brand yourself while you're in college? Well, you're ready to move on to the next step. How do you brand yourself online? Get ready.
I got to tell you, some of you guys are real good. I'm looking
Agreed.
For you. If you, you know, put a picture of your nail polish online, you got like 5,000 likes, I need you. So let's amplify each other. And I think that's actually really important. Some of you guys, again, are really good at branding yourselves. And I think you know exactly who you are and what you're interested in. I think what's important is to connect to those organizations, those businesses that are actually looking for you, and we'll help each other. I have one of my old interns, if she had tweeted something, she'd get 1,000 people to show up somewhere I never could. So we're looking for influencers. And I'm not gonna sit here and say everybody can do it. but most of you can. You have more followers than me, and I don't know how. I think that's the most important thing to say is own your power. We know you have power, and we're trying to harness it. Help us. I drive an hour up here all the time because somebody asked me to, but 99% of the time, none of you guys call me back. And then you make me come back up here again. Those connections are really important, and I was telling some of the young people earlier, relationships are everything and not just your digital relationships. Yeah. If you don't know half those people, fine, but you should know at least a quarter, okay? And that's gonna be really important for whatever you do digitally, but more importantly for your job development and your life. Mm-hmm.
As an organizer or as a business, how do you guys harvest the pull that these influencers have? How does that work?
I just want to bounce off this because, honestly, I said this in the class earlier, there's never been a time, I don't think, in the history of life where it used to be like when I graduated, the internet was kind of a thing. I mean, there wasn't, smartphones weren't a thing, but like the internet was a thing. It certainly wasn't the powerful tool that it is today. And so, before, what used to happen in the corporate world was you graduate from college, you get some, you know, entry-level job, you work hard, then you get a slightly better job, and then a slightly better job, after years and years of hustling and going and going and going and working, right? And that's how it used to be. Now, there's never been an opportunity for a young person to sit at the same seat at the boardroom table with an executive that's been in the industry for 50 years because they need you, to their point. They need you because there's stuff like, I'm 32, I run a digital marketing agency, and I talked to a class earlier, and they mentioned some piece of tech that I had not heard of. And I'm like, okay, I shouldn't admit that at the media summit, and I just did. But, so block that out, TV people. But it's just amazing how fast and rapidly technology is changing. And as a business, I look for that. I look for people to come in and innovate because as a digital marketing agency, things change literally every day. The algorithm change, both social and search engine algorithms change, the platforms change, the things that user intent, user consumer behavior, that changes every day. And so as you guys graduate, you're gonna know stuff that I'm certainly not gonna know. And we need that to infuse that in our business to stay relevant. Because you know what, in 10 years, Digital Hive, if we exist as we are today, we ain't gonna have any clients because we aren't gonna be relevant. So we need people to infuse that into our world for sure.
Okay, so the students, they know a ton is what we're finding out from this panel discussion. We're going to invite them up here. Are we ready here to invite them up to give a couple questions in just a few minutes? First, I guess we gotta, if we could start the lineup, but Jeff, I guess I'll ask you one more question. Is that your management style to get out of the way and let these people just innovate?
Yeah, I just did a social media conference actually Friday and it was all about leadership. And I talked about servant leadership, and I think that's, like I talked about, there's an old kind of way of doing things and a new way, and Digital Hive is very much like a Google-esque organization. We have beanbag chairs and an arcade, and like, you know, we have ping pong table and free snacks, which is ridiculous, but that's what we do. So, like, it's just what people expect. It's just what, like, you know, everybody expects these days, and we want to, the only reason we've grown like we have is because we have an incredible staff. The only smart thing that I did was, A, I took a risk and started a business, and B, I hired smart people and got the hell out of the way. Because we take extra time to find who are we going to add to our championship team. That's what I kind of feel like we're building is a championship team. But there's no LeBrons on our team. It's literally everyone needs to play a very specific part to help us grow. But if you're going to contribute to Digital Hive's growth, I need to contribute to your personal growth and your professional growth. And so it is not a one street any longer, I don't feel like. I feel like, you know, a lot because of the skill set that a lot of students are coming out of school with, they have choices. And we want to make sure that we are the most attractive to the highest talent people.
So, aren't
absolutely.
You the LeBron? You don't think you're the LeBron?
Oh, no, I
totally think you're the LeBron.
No, I am nowhere close to LeBron. No.
I think
it's
the LeBron.
No, I am close.
All right, let's hear from the students. Do we have a very first question out there? Do we?
Question.
Yeah.
Hi.
Let's hear it.
Hello. I kind of want to link LaToya Lee and Ms. Boatner. I'm interested in what you said about a platform and a platform. And yes, there is Latino Twitter.
Woohoo!
We exist. Ms. Lee, what's the best way for ethnic groups to go viral when you just said, for example, it's harder for them to reach a certain audience because we are disenfranchised. So what are ways that within our platform we connect to other platforms? What do you think is the best way to go around that?
Well, I think the important part there is, for what reason do you want to go viral, right? Is it because of some sort of social cause? Is it just to build some sort of type of community, right? And that matters. But if it's just to go viral to build communities, there are lots of those. For example, natural hair communities are super big. They have, you guys know, YouTube, taken over YouTube channels. Corporations, marketing teams have reached out to them so that they can become the ones, the brand ambassadors, to market to regular folks like us, right? And we listen to them because they're being entrusted by this corporation to market to us, right? So I think in that sense, it's just about creating this platform where you're speaking to the particular community that you want to speak to. If you want to go viral, or for other organizations that have gone viral, oftentimes it's reactive and it's after something has happened, right? So like BLM, literally Black Lives Matter, emerged after the Trayvon Martin case, right? And that's what kind of kept them going and going along the way.
Dr. Lee, I was reading some of your work on Black Twitter.
Yes.
And how the community responded to an AP headline.
Yes, that Associated Press.
That was victim blaming. In the news media, we now hear so many voices from so many people.
Yes.
Of angry over headlines or story content. Do you want to tell us what happened in that specific incident?
Yes. So Renisha McBride was someone who was killed in Detroit by a homeowner, and the Associated was seeking help after a car accident and was shot and killed on the doorstep. And the Associated Press created this headline where they seemed to be victim blaming Renisha McBride for her own death. And Black Twitter was up in arms. And for those of you who don't know what Black, how many of you guys know what Black Twitter is?
Okay, great.
So you're all on board.
Hashtag stay woke.
So you know then that Black Twitter operates through hashtags, right? It's not like a separate platform. There was a separate
I was just about to catch. I was like, there was a separate, yes.
There was for some time, and that kind of went awry. we'll talk about that later. But Black Twitter exists within Twitter, within the Twitter platform. And they basically created this hashtag AP headlines where they were making fun of Associated Press by using real life examples and things that have happened historically to show them the ways that they were victim blaming. And Associated Press responded. They noticed and they changed their headlines.
And that could never happen before.
Never happened before. But I mean, it talks to this voice that you do have in numbers in these particular spaces, right?
If I could add to that real quick, the one of the proudest moments that I've had in my career, well, one of them in Digital Hive's career, business history, is we ran the most recent, the current mayor's campaign in Syracuse. He's Ben Walsh. He ran as an independent. He had a long line history of Republicans as family members. Syracuse is a 56% Democratic city. Democrats always win that city. And he ran as independent because he wanted to show he wasn't like his family. That said, he was a 35-year-old white guy, right? And so all the minorities in the community, you know, it was expected that, like, they're going to look at him and, like, it's more of the same, right? It's just like a middle-aged white guy, you know, what does he know about, you know, minorities, right? Or, yeah, younger white guy for sure. And so...
35 is middle-aged. Yeah,
yeah. I'll need to catch up.
Oh my God. What's going to happen?
Find out. So what we did was, we really... I just want to talk about the disenfranchised piece to this, because you know I'm also a minority, and I think that right now minorities have an even more powerful voice with social media, because they now can they may not have ever been able to connect directly to a mayoral candidate before. Syracuse is one of the I think it's like the ninth biggest city in poverty. One out of two children in the city of Syracuse live in poverty today in Syracuse, so literally 50%. And the majority of Syracuse residents are minorities. And so he needed to connect them because that's his constituents. And so we had Helen Hudson, who was a common counselor, she was an African American, endorse Ben. And we had a lot of minorities surround Ben, Democrats around Ben. And we really showcased that piece to it. And we had an incredible response from these communities. In other way, in the history, in past, it would have been very hard to connect to them, and it would have been very hard for them to connect to Ben. And so he had a lot of forums. He went to those communities. He talked to them individually about their concerns, some police issues, and some other things. And overwhelmingly through the African American community, he won their vote by a long stretch. And so I think that social media played a huge role in that. They actually called him at Syracuse.com. They called him the social media king. And I think that it was a really good way to engage. And now he's living through with those promises, right?
Well, I think it's important to add, because I'm on the other end of that, that I think we can admit, too, there was a Facebook faux pas, if you will, that completely changed the way that race was going.
Yes.
And we won't get into what happened.
I'm not from here. Somebody tell me what happened.
But it did. Somebody made a very unfortunate comment that seemed tiny, and it changed the whole thing. And, jumping on that media moment really helped solidify that race.
Absolutely.
Okay, let's move on to the next question.
What's your guys' opinion on cancel culture, especially in social media? Because a lot of the time, a lot of influencers, they get canceled for one specific belief that they have, even though I'm sure, as we all know, people are capable of change.
So when you say cancel culture, you mean when people's accounts get deactivated?
No, what I mean is like literally when somebody tweets something, someone disagrees with it, and they go, oh, you're canceled.
Oh.
This is something new? Yeah. Jeff, I don't know that. I thought she was talking about a TV show.
It's because the median age is 35 for these things.
So it feels like you're fired.
We're over the hill.
Well, I don't understand. Like, how do you get canceled?
You're canceled.
You're just canceled. Ethan is like, literally, he's canceled. No, I'm kidding. Like, can you explain a little? Because I don't know this.
Okay. Back home, I work in a grassroots organization too, and I've seen a lot of people come and go just because like they have drama with other people, and that drama or like specific beliefs that they have like causes people to, I guess, cancel each other. It's the same idea, and even though we all are working towards the same movement, why is it that we cancel each other out?
Jeff talks about this a little bit in terms of thinking about these spaces as becoming echo chambers.
Mm-hmm, definitely.
And then when you have someone who does not agree with you, is because of that like button and unlike button and follow button and unfollow button, we've become accustomed to just unfollowing instead of engaging, or blocking instead of engaging. And I think that may have a part to do with it in terms of we're becoming socialized into no longer engaging anymore, right? It's just quite easier to block, to cancel.
So I'll say from an influencer, so that's one of my roles at IBM is influencer communications. And so when we look at influencers that we work with, and we don't do pay for play. Some brands do pay influencers to like endorse and things like that. We don't do that. When we look at influencers, it's really important for me when I vet them to go through people who align with the IBM brand. Like I'm not gonna get somebody who's kind of like off brand or controversial. If someone, has a lot of drama, if someone is like every day talking about how, hashtag white privilege, hashtag the man gets me down, hashtag, like if it's like that, my CEO is a white female. Like I can't, it doesn't align with my brand. So I would cancel them because they don't align with my brand. If there's someone, it's one thing to have an opinion. We all have opinions, right? It's one thing to have an opinion on social. It's another thing to be like really emotional and just like erratic and just say like things all the time. And then drama, you said something interesting. You said we're all working towards the same goal. Well, then why is there drama? Then is that person just like someone, and y'all know that there are people out here who just love drama. Like it goes everywhere, it's like a cloud. Everywhere they go, it's like over their head. So maybe that's it, but you have to do something like seriously, like if I'm gonna cancel you, now that I know what that means, I'm going back to work and I'm like, you canceled.
You canceled.
You canceled. I cannot wait to do this.
I hear you, actually, because this is a problem we do not talk about in social movements.
Cancellation?
Like, canceling is not cool. That's not cute.
Oh my goodness.
Because you, again, to LaToya's point, these are echo chambers. These movements, these hashtags tend to be unnuanced. And so when we pass them along, we think that everyone is in alignment with that moment. Yeah. It's not true. And then how are we opening that space up for difference? And I think that's a real conversation that we need to start having with any of these movements without canceling people who disagree with us.
Yeah.
Because then the movements go nowhere, they don't get deeper. You're coercing people
that's
at that
I mean
point.
That's what I mean with emotional, yes.
So we won't cancel you. We actually need that moment. You can come talk to us.
No, you can come talk to us.
I want to add to that also, Black Twitter is also infamous for this. Because Black Twitter are moments when people come together and talk about a particular thing. But we know as a culture, we're not a monolith and that we all have different ideas and views and opinions. And we may not necessarily have the same fights, right? Or want to fight for the same things. And those are moments where you see like Black Twitter in disarray, right?
Yes.
But that's normal in terms of we're not a monolith. And it's this ideal that we're all on the same train and we're all thinking the same thing, and that's not necessarily the case.
Okay.
And a lot of movements, digital movements and regular traditional movements fall apart during these
because of cancellations.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
This is new.
They fall apart because
Media Summit
they don't know
cancellation.
They don't know how to respond to that. So they cancel each other out. They end up canceling each other out, and that becomes where the movement fizzled.
Do you want to start a cancellation movement? Because I fully support you. Take it up with Lou. We'll do that 19.
Jeff, when you talk about echo chambers and the algorithms reinforcing some of these beliefs, and maybe that's part of the reason that we have such a segmented set of views and people are so angry in our society, do you think Facebook, maybe Twitter to a certain degree, you might have missed this? Do they have a duty to change the algorithms to expose people to different points of view?
So I have a pretty strong opinion on this because here's the thing. When you signed up for a social media profile, right, you didn't pay any money. None of us paid for a Facebook account. None of us paid for a Twitter account. None of us paid for any of that stuff. And so the premium in which you pay is the data that you give them, right? So like everything you like, comment, share, retweet, whatever, that is put in a profile, and all of a sudden that interest you have or that thing you've liked or that thing you engaged with, now they know that about you. Plus, they overlay a ton of data because Google, make no mistake, the $88 billion in Google, $34 billion in advertising revenue in Facebook, like these companies know everything about you, online and offline. They know everything about you because we've given them the permission to follow us wherever we go. And so I think that, I think their duty as a private company is to do whatever it's going to take to make their users more engaged, less engaged, whatever their prerogative as a social media is. Now, that said, Google and Facebook now have more advertising revenue than every newspaper, radio station, and magazine in the world combined.
And ad agencies. They're making more than ad agencies.
Oh, much more. I mean, if you think about it, so like Google and Facebook, they're not like, I'm not saying every search engine, not every social media. I'm saying Google and Facebook, two massive companies, now have more advertising revenue than platforms do that have been around forever, since Gutenberg, right? Yeah. All the Condé Nast publications out of the city and all that. So all take that advertising revenue, combine it. It's not even touching these two. So I think that there is going to need to be more regulation on these two companies because it's how we as consumers just engage in this data and engage in the information that we get. And so I think that over time there will be regulation, but it's about who's regulated, right? And so it's a slippery slope because do we rely on the private organizations to regulate themselves or do we rely on a government in which we elect to help to regulate these things? And it's no different than the FCC and TV when it first started and the responsibilities they had. And so I think it's a complex situation, but it's definitely one in which we need to have because it will continue to, I think, put us down a path of separation, but also unity at times. I think we can do both.
Let's move on to the next question, if we could.
Hello, everybody.
Hi, David.
It's going all right. Okay. My question is for all the panelists, but I want to go and just make a comment about something that Jeff said. He said he was trying to build a team of all-stars. And my question is, like, what does it take to become an all-star? So if you're trying to be someone in the field of media marketing, what kind of traits and skills are you looking for? Are you looking for someone who's good at data analytics? Are you looking at someone who's good at writing? Someone who has, like, what is the skill that most people entering the field are lacking and then need to have to become an all-star?
That's a great question. I am so impressed. I was impressed earlier, but I'm like really impressed now. I'll just say, just for me, I love all stars, and it's funny because I think of Jeff as LeBron. Okay, so maybe I'll be like Kobe, but these are some of the traits I find just coming into like the corporate environment and then PR. I know your teachers say this, but writing, definitely. But one thing I like to say to students when I work at a technology company is in understanding technological innovation, but coding. Even if you're not a computer science major, if you take a basic coding class just to learn HTML, JavaScript, I taught myself Python because my developers at work told me, oh, you should learn JavaScript, that's easier. And I was like, excuse me, you don't know me. I can do Python. If it's hard, I'm doing it. Forget you. So I taught it to myself. But coding is something. But I have a list of 15 skills I think makes an all-star in my field. Writing is one, coding, SEO, visual literacy. You all students need to understand, and you guys are in a great school for this. There's visuals, you guys do a lot with radio and TV and images, and then there's being visually literate, which I don't think everyone actually has. Like, does this look good on a mobile phone? Vertical versus horizontal, understanding that everybody can see colors, colorblind, font choices, accessibility. You guys know most of the videos that are made with sound off, because if you think about, at least in class or at work, we're not supposed to be watching the videos, so we have the sound off. Are you making content that's sound off? Like, that's visual literacy, right? And I think that sometimes you forget that. Writing, as I mentioned, can come up with like a whole bunch of just like strategy, planning, but like I said, I have a list of 15. You should like talk to me if you wanna know the 15, but that's what makes an all-star. And listen, if you can do 5 of the 15 really, really well, I definitely want you on my team. Definitely. I'm not gonna say you can do all 15. It'd be great if you can do all 15, but 5 of the 15, excellent. I don't know about you, LeBron. What do you think?
I will take that nickname all day. I'm good with it. For me, and I kind of talked about this in a lot of the classes that I spoke in, but again, we have developed an incredible team, and I can't take credit for all of the growth we've had. It's really been them. I think the biggest contribution to that is, one is that we hired a director of HR as our 4th employee. So we were only 3 people, and we were like, hey, let's hire a director of HR. And everybody made fun of us because they're like, you're 3 people, why do you need a director of HR? But we knew that culture was going to be the number one thing that we wanted to focus on as we build out as our agency. The reason for that is because we're a service-based business. So we need to have all stars on the team to be able to, look, if you're going for a job that's a digital marketing producer, you need to be good at optimizing Facebook ads. You need to be good at optimizing Google ads. You need to know, maybe it's SEO, maybe it's, so there's specific skill sets. But if you're going to be an account manager, it's more soft skills. It's more like relationship building and things like that. For us though, skills are like a far distant second. The first thing that we ever hire for is culture. So when we interview people, the majority of the questions we'll ask in the first interview is like, tell me about yourself, tell me about your personality, what do you like to do outside of work, tell me about how you've come, you know, have you ever come up against adversity and how did you handle those things? Because we want to be able to have a litmus test of, is this person gonna fit well within our culture? Because if you can't work well with the team, you can't work here. Right? It's the number one thing. I don't care if you're the best developer in the world. I don't care if you are the most, you know, the best salesperson. If you don't get along with our team that we've built, you don't belong here. It doesn't mean you're a bad person. It's just that's the first thing we look for. And then after that, we say, all right, you know, can you actually execute this? Or can we teach you? Because a lot of things that we do are teachable skills. So, you know, that, I guess the practical application to that is in interviews, just be yourself. Just be, you know, show your personality, open up. You know, it's important to be professional, but at the same time, like, I got my job, very frankly, I wasn't qualified to get my first job out of school, but I made a lot of jokes. Like, I made a lot of jokes, probably too many. And the dude that hired me, and the reason I did it, because I could read the guy that was hiring me, we just got along really well. We joked around a bunch. He liked my personality, and it was a sales job, so a lot of soft skills. And then he took a chance on me, you know? So a lot of times, that's really all it is make the person across from you comfortable. Because we spend more time with our staff and our coworkers than we do with our wives and kids and all that stuff, because 40 hours out of our week, right? And so you want to like the person. The interviewer wants to like the person first. And so I think that's, for me, that's what it's all about.
Okay. We have time for one last question.
Make it a good one. No pressure.
On.
Well, when I came here, of course, I was dressed like most of you. A lot of you are dressed professionally. And when it comes to dressing in this industry, it has a big effect on how you're perceived. And perception is very big in broadcasting and mass communication. So my question to you guys is, with the new role of social media and social advocacy, would you say that the how you are viewed and how you're portrayed and your look is very important to social media platforms? So do you guys think that it's social media's duty to dress themselves professionally and to correct the issues themselves for virtual advocacy? So later down the road, issues that we see nowadays, like you guys were talking with echo chambers, those can be prevented more, not because they're going through the initiatives of preventing it, but they're actually going ahead and taking care of those issues so we could be more connected in the community of a virtual reality.
Yeah, like I like what you have on. It's cold out. The sweatshirt. So like, even if you didn't know that like, you were coming here, you know, whatever. I think it's. I'm on a college campus. Like the fact that everyone's like dressed up, I think it's great. You're at a media summit, but I have no problem with what you're wearing at all. Like, you know, your pants look nice. You see the shoes.
You get a full critique, man.
Shoes are. You're good. You look. Oh, I think you look great. So own that. If you didn't dress up, I think it really, you know, perception is reality, right? Especially when someone just, you have like, you know, when you meet someone, the first 5 seconds, they make like 15 impressions about you just looking at you. And so there's a lot to be said for that. It depends on like the job that you're going for or depends on the environment that you're in. Just everything that we're saying about being digital advocates, that doesn't have like a dress code, right? Or having a voice or a viral voice doesn't have a dress code. Now, if I want my voice to be heard to a board of directors, I am certainly going to dress a certain way because I want them to make sure that, you know, my voice is heard. They don't look at like what I'm wearing. Also, as females, and you know, I can't speak for Jeff because he looks really good in the jeans, but we have to be very mindful of what we wear. That could be misinterpreted if we're trying to advocate for something. Oh, did you see she was wearing a short skirt or her dress was too short, or, which can take away from the very thing that you were trying to accomplish. So it depends on, you know, the environment. It depends on what you're advocating for. But to have a voice, as I'm sure you do, to advocate for something on Twitter or Facebook, to bring connectedness, whether you're in this environment or not, what you have on works for me. Works for me.
I agree. And I will say, you know, if you're going to, you know, have a campus movement, what you're wearing is
perfect.
Great.
If you came in a suit, I was shirts, like, he's selling something. I don't
weird.
Want it.
Yeah.
I don't want any of that. You look fine.
You're not 22.
I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say, though, but there are moments where you don't want to do that. Even that same person who's an organizer, if you're in front of, you know, the footsteps of the major organization, mm-hmm. you might want to be wearing pants. You know, we have made that mistake, not me personally. But I have seen people make that mistake where all of a sudden the news shows up and you're standing there with our brand sign in your booty shorts, super not cute. But also we have to remember that at least from my organization or my position, you never know when a camera's gonna show up or a politician.
Asa can be there real quick. Real quick on the scene, real quick. Mic in hand, makeup on, real quick.
And so you have to remember you have multiple audiences when you're online or when somebody has a camera or, you know, a cell phone. So it might be, you know, a college student might be looking at that, what I'm saying that day, but also a politician or a business leader. So I try to keep that in mind, depending on the space that I'm in or whatever the action is. I think you just got to be a little cognizant, you know, cognizant of where you're at.
I'm the first, I think I'm the first panelist dude that's worn jeans to this, so I'm sorry, President Stanley and Lou, for disrespecting the stage. I also wore sneakers, because thanks for pointing that out. But, you know, they know who they were inviting. I'm a digital guy. This is my dress code.
I'm
throwing a coat
girl.
Today. That's
I'm a digital
big,
girl.
That's a big thing.
Pop a color, Jeff.
Right? Exactly.
LeBron.
Look at Zuckerberg. He gets away with hoodies every day.
Okay.
So, you know, but I agree. I think it really is based on the situation. situation. I love that the dude wears a sweatsuit and was like, yo, I wore a sweatsuit today, you know, like, is that cool?
Cool.
It's totally cool. Because I think you said it, you gotta own it, right? You gotta own
He did,
what
he
it
came
is.
Up, he's he like, came, I know I'm not dressed, you did that.
Yeah, you did, you did, and I think that's the most important thing is, you know, I can walk into a boardroom dressed exactly like this, and I know it is different for women, so I don't want to take anything away from that, but I can dress, you know, with jeans, but as long as the content that I have is relevant and important and it's maybe something that I'm adding to the conversation, they'll probably listen to me. And I think that's really the biggest point is you don't want your dress apparel to be a distraction. That's the number one thing. Don't let it be a distraction.
Yeah. I understood your question as dressing up your social media account. And I think that is very important because you all will leave Oswego and you will go out into the world and be looking for jobs. And they will search your social media account. So you need to be mindful of this, right? And a plug, right, really quick plug. Oswego Career Center actually has a service where they can go through your digital identity and help you shape your digital identity. So be mindful of that. What you post at 12 years old can follow you at 35 when you're, would you say mid-age?
You guys don't have a long way to go.
When you're 35, having a midlife crisis, what you post at 12 can follow you. So be mindful of that. And we see this all the time with celebrities. So be mindful of that. And yes, you do need to dress up your social media account.
This is not an exaggeration. I literally almost didn't start Digital Hive because my business partner, Jake, I went to his Facebook profile and I went a few pictures deep and literally he was in like an Ed Hardy shirt with like four girls like this, like drunk on a boat. And I was like, oh, who am I getting involved with right now? So it is, you guys, you should be aware for sure. You can have fun in social media, but there's ways to block that stuff. Like just make it so that the public can't see the things that you have fun with and dress it up appropriately, especially as you go in the professional world. Because look, we look at everything. Like if anybody does any interviewing, we look at it all.
We do.
So make sure you got it cleaned up.
Okay, that's all we have for right now. So our panelists, we thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
Good job, guys.
And I think we learned today how much power the students have coming right out of SUNY Oswego.
Absolutely.
So don't underestimate yourselves. We'll send it over to Professor Ricky.
Thank you, Asa. Let's hear it one more time for our distinguished group of panelists. Hopefully you're walking away with some new information today and helpful information as you pursue your own goals. Speaking of goals, if you want to do a little more networking this afternoon, just up the stairs and to your left in the Tyler Hall Art Gallery, a networking event. You'll get to meet with some of our recent alumni, our career connectors. So please stop by, say hello, and mingle with them. They have plenty of their own stories and advice to share with you as well. Thank you all for coming to the 14th annual Lewis B. O'Donnell Media Summit. We thank you for your attention and attendance. Have a great day.